Where there is mind, is also deception. Deception is there is. In a body-arching squeal of agony, Krydike screamed one undisciplined cry in primal, the first of his adult life. Then he rolled belly up to drift in a blackness deeper than night. Part 4. Leviathan. Oh, my father was the keeper of the Eddystone light. He slept with the mermaid one fine night. From this union there came three, a porpoise, a porgy, and me. Oh, for the life on the rolling sea. Old Chanty. Chapter 35. Jillian. Like most species derived from wholly carnivorous forebears, the Tandu were difficult clients. They had cannibalistic tendencies, and attacks on individuals of their patron race, the Nikt Six, weren't unheard of early in their uplift. The Tandu have remarkably low empathy for other sapient life forms. They are members of a pseudo-religious alignment whose tenets propose the eventual extermination of species judged unworthy. While they observe the codes of the galactic institutes, the Tandu make no secret of their desire for a less crowded universe, or their eagerness for the day when all laws are swept aside by a higher power. According to the followers of their inheritor alignment, this will happen when the progenitors return to the five galaxies. The Tandu assume that they will be chosen, come that day, to hunt down the unworthy. While waiting for this millennium, the Tandu keep in practice by indulging in countless minor skirmishes and battles of honor. They join in any war of enforcement declared by the galactic institutes, whatever the cause, and are often cited for use of excess force, accidental extinction of at least three spacefaring species has been attributed to them. Although the race has little empathy for their patron-level peers, the Tandu are masters of the art of uplift. In their pre-sentient form, on their fallow homeworld, they had already tamed several local species for use as hunting animals, the equivalent of tracking dogs on Earth. Since release from indenture, the Tandu have acquired and adapted two of the most powerful psychic adepts of the recent crop of clients. The Tandu are under long-term investigation for excessive genetic manipulation in making the two, see references Apesiarch CL-82F49, Acceptor CL-82F50, totally dependent instruments of their love of the hunt. Nice people, these Tandu, Jillian thought, putting the flat reading plate down beside the tree where she sat. She had allotted herself an hour for reading this morning, but had covered only 200,000 words or so. This entry on the Tandu had come over the cable from Streaker last night. Apparently the NIS machine was already accomplishing things with the mini-library Tom had retrieved from the Thenanin wreck. This report read too clearly, and came to the point too directly to have come straight from the English translation software of Streaker's own pathetic little micro-branch. Of course, Jillian already knew some things about the Tandu. All Terrigan's agents were taught about these secretive, brutal enemies of mankind. This report only reinforced her feeling that there was something terribly wrong with a universe that had such monsters in it. Jillian had once spent a summer reading ancient space romances from pre-contact days. How open and friendly those old-time fictional universes had seemed. Even the rare pessimistic ones hadn't come close to the closed, confined, dangerous reality. Thinking about the Tandu put her in a melodramatic mind to carry around a dirk and to exercise a woman's ancient last prerogative, should those murderous creatures ever capture her. The thick organic smell of humus overwhelmed the metallic tang that permeated everywhere near the water. The aroma was fresh after last night's storm. Green fronds waved slowly under gentle buffeting from Kithrop's incessant trade winds. Tom must have found his island crucible by now, she thought, and begun preparing his experiment. If he still lives. This morning, for the first time, she felt uncertain about that. She had been so sure she would know it if he died, wherever or whenever it happened. Yet now she felt confused. Her mind was muddied, and all she could tell for certain was that terrible things had happened last night. First, around sunset, had come a crawling premonition that something had happened to Tom. She couldn't pin the feeling down, but it disturbed her. Then, late last night, she had had a series of dreams. There had been faces, galactic faces, leathern and feathered and scaled, toothed and mandibled. They yammered and howled, but she, in spite of all her expensive training, couldn't understand a single word or sense glyph. A few of the jumbled faces she had recognized in her sleep, a pair of zappish spacemen dying as their ship was torn apart, a Jofer howling through smoke at the bleeding stump of its arm, a Cynthian listening to whale songs while she waited impatiently behind a vacuum-cold lump of stone. In her sleep, Jillian had been helpless to keep them out. She had awakened suddenly in the middle of the night to a tremor that plucked her spine like a bowstring. Breathing heavily in the darkness, she sensed a kindred consciousness writhe in agony at the limit of her range. In spite of the distance, Jillian caught a mixed flavor in the fleeting psychic glyph. It felt too human to have been only a fin, too cetacean to have been merely a man. Then it ceased. The psychic onslaught was over. She didn't know what to make of any of it. What use was Psi if its messages were too opaque to be deciphered? Her genetically enhanced intuition now seemed a cruel deception, worse than useless. She had a few moments left to her hour. She spent them with her eyes closed, listening to the rise and fall of sound as breakers fought their endless battle with the western shoreline. Tree limbs brushed and swayed with the wind. Interleaved with the creakings of trunk and branch, Jillian could hear the high chittering squeaks of the aboriginal presentience, the Kikwi. From time to time, she made out the voice of Denny Sudman speaking into a machine that translated her words into the high-frequency Kikwi dialect. Though she was working 12 hours a day helping Denny, Jillian couldn't help feeling guiltily that she was taking a vacation. She reminded herself that the little natives were extremely important, and that she had just been spinning her wheels back at the ship. But one of the faces from her dream had stuck with her all morning. Only a half hour ago, she had realized that it was her own subconscious rendering of what Herbie, the ancient cadaver, which had caused all this trouble, must have looked like when he was alive. In her dream, shortly before she had begun feeling premonitions of disaster, the long, vaguely humanoid face of the ancient had smiled at her and slowly winked. Jillian, Dr. Baskin, it's time. She opened her eyes, lifted her arm, and glanced at her watch. It might as well have been set by Toshio's voice. Trust a midshipman at his word, she remembered. Tell him to fetch you in 1 hour, and he'll time it down to the second. Early in the voyage, she had had to threaten dire measures to get him to call her Sir, or the anachronistic Ma'am, only in every third sentence rather than every other word. On my way, Toshio, just a minute. She rose to her feet and stretched. The rest break had been useful. Her mind had been in knots that only quiet could smooth. She had hoped to finish here and get back to Streaker within 3 days, about the time Krydike had planned to move the ship. By then, she and Denny should have worked out the environmental needs of the Kikwi, how to take a small sample group with them back to the Center for Uplift on Earth. If Streaker got away, and if humanity first filed a client claim, it could save the Kikwi from a far worse fate. On her way through the trees, Jillian caught a glimpse of the ocean through a northeast gap in the greenery. "Will I be able to feel it here when Tom calls?" The NIS said his signal should be detectable anywhere on the planet. All the ETs will hear it, for sure. She carefully kept all psychic energies low, as Tom had insisted she do, but she did form an old-fashioned prayer with her mouth, and cast it northward over the waves. "I'll bet this will please Dr. Dart," Toshio said. "Of course, the sensors might not be types he'd want, but the bot is still operational." Jillian examined the small screen. She was no expert on robotics or planetology, but she understood the principles. "I think you're right, Toshio. The X-ray spectrometer works, so do the laser zapper and the magnetometer. Can the robot still move?" "Like a little rock lobster. The only thing it can't do is float back up. Its buoyancy tanks were ruptured when the piece of coral crashed down on it." "Where is the robot now?" "It's on a ledge about 90 meters down." Toshio tapped the tiny keyboard and brought a holo schematic into space in front of the screen. "It's given me a sonar map that deep. I've held off going any lower until I talk to Dr. Dart. We can only go down one ledge at a time. Once the robot leaves a spot, there's no going back." The schematic showed a slightly tapered cylindrical cavity descending into the metal-rich silicate rock of Kithrop's thin crust. The walls were studded with outcrops and ledges, like the one the crippled probe now rested on. A solid shaft ran up the great cavity, tilted at a slight angle. It was the great drill route Toshio and Denny had blown apart a few days earlier. The upper end rested against one rim of its own underwater excavation. The shaft disappeared into unknown territory below the mapped area. "I think you're right, Toshio." Jillian grinned and squeezed the boy's shoulder. "Charlie will be glad about this. It may help get him off Krydike's back. Do you want to ring him up with the news?" Toshio was obviously pleased with the compliment, but taken aback by Jillian's offer.
No, thank you, sir. I mean, couldn't you just tuck this in when you report to the ship today? I'm sure Dr. Dart will have questions I'm not qualified to handle."
Jillian couldn't blame Toshio. Presenting good news to Charles Dart was barely more pleasant than delivering bad news. But Toshio would have to come to grips with the chimp planetologist sooner or later. It would be best if he learned to deal with the problem from the start.
"Sorry, Toshio. Dr. Dart is all yours. Don't forget that I'm leaving here in a few days. You're the one who's going to have to satisfy Charlie when he asks you to put in 30-hour shifts."
Toshio nodded seriously, taking her advice soberly, until she managed to catch eye contact with him. She grinned until he couldn't help but blush and smile.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 5,